From KCUR, I'm Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. John Denver's Rocky Mountain High is Colorado's state song, and the marijuana legalization law that went into effect this year may have been what the late musician had in mind. This hour, our ethics professors return to discuss the problems that surround marijuana, which is still illegal under federal law, but increasingly accepted in many states. And later, Brian McTavish brings us his picks for the weekend to-do list. On Up to Date, after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Only two states, Washington and Colorado, have legalized marijuana for recreational use. Beyond them, 20 states and the District of Columbia have more or less legalized the drug for medical purposes. But smoking a joint remains illegal under federal law, leaving a country beset with two standards that send mixed messages. Did Colorado and Washington make the right decisions or not? How can marijuana be illegal in some places but not others? Our ethics professors are in the house today to explore all of this, and we'll also ask them about the 33-year-old Texas woman who was brain dead and pregnant. It was her wish not to be left on life support, but the state won't allow her to be taken off it. The ethics professors today are Wayne Vaught. He's the dean of the UMKC College of Arts and Sciences. He's also a professor of philosophy, medicine, and bioethics. And Wayne, always good to have you.
Great to be here. Thanks again,
for braving the cold here. And also with us today is a guest ethics professor, Wayne Lucas. He's a retired UMKC professor of criminal justice and criminology. And Wayne, so good to have you too.
Thank you.
Welcome aboard.
Thanks.
Yeah. Well, Wayne, you always do such a good job at setting the table on these big issues. What kind of ethical can of worms has the states of Colorado and Washington opened up here by making recreational use of marijuana legal now?
Well, I mean, they're challenging other states are challenging the federal government to really think about what the rights of individuals are, what the freedoms are for people to pursue their various versions of the American dream of their own perceptions of individual liberties, and have provided now some wider liberties for individuals to have. The obvious question then becomes, from a social standpoint and an ethical standpoint, are what are the goods that come of this? What are the potential harms that can result from legalized marijuana? And we would have to fold into this not just marijuana, but the other primary legalized drug that we look at are alcohol. And mm-hmm. So are there concerns about people's use, or particularly abuse, misuse of this, that could cause significant harms to the individual, him or herself, or society, such as society actually does begin to develop a moral right and obligation to regulate, impose laws, restrict, outlaw access to these drugs. And I think what we're seeing with marijuana, and what you're seeing certainly a strong public opinion about, is that this particular drug is no more harmful than other drugs that are currently legally available. Certainly it could be abused and misused, though perhaps not as harmful as some other legally available recreational drugs that you can buy at your liquor store. And so the question is there a legitimate interest that the government has to impede or restrict a person's access and a person's liberty interest in respect to this particular drug? And I would probably have to agree with them that, no, there doesn't appear to be said harm. And so the onus, from my perspective, and I think from an ethical perspective, is for the government to show that there is credible evidence to support limiting an individual's freedom in this regard.
And has that happened in your view?
I don't believe so at all.
Yeah, yeah. No. Wayne Lucas, this notion now, you come at this from a criminal justice background here, not a criminal background, but a criminal justice background. This notion now that we have two sets of standards across the country, though, for law enforcement types, this has to be something of a nightmare. Am I guessing that right?
Yeah, it is. It is rather confusing to people. They have difficulty trying to understand why the federal government basically has one set of rules, and then states are left essentially to to establish an opposing set of rules. I think a lot of the movement towards legalization, particularly in terms of marijuana, has centered around a lot of pragmatic concerns. It's very expensive to continue to use limited law enforcement, courts, and corrections kinds of budgets to go after individuals that are, in many instances, aren't really threatening folks in a significant way. Now, that's not to say that there aren't particular dangers or concerns with individuals using marijuana.
Yeah.
But the issue often comes up about, you know, how far should the government go in terms of trying to protect someone from themselves?
So on one level, you're saying that maybe law enforcement is relieved that this category of crime, I'm putting quotes around the word crime, is off the books here.
Yes, I think so. In fact, there's been an organization developed that goes by the acronym LEAP, but it's Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And it's primarily made up of usually retired or ex-officers who have come together and have advocated the repeal of prohibition, particularly in terms of marijuana, because they don't see any real impact of it in terms of sort of reducing problems or reducing the amount of drug use in society.
Mm-hmm. But still, though, we're left with other states around the country who are dealing with this double standard now. You arrest, you know, a kid in western Kansas, and the kid's going to say, well, just across the border, 5 miles away, it's legal, it's illegal here. What's up with that?
Right.
You know?
Yeah, that basically comes from the dual system of government that we have in our country, where states do have certain freedoms to develop their own particular laws in areas, and this is an area essentially of shared power between federal and states. And so that becomes the basis, mm-hmm. essentially, to maybe try to explain this the conflict here.
Mm-hmm.
But it is conflicting and it is confusing.
Let's get our listeners involved here. This is such a hot topic. So many folks will want to chat about this today. Did Colorado and Washington make the right decisions here to legalize pot or recreational use of pot or not? How confusing is it, maybe for young people especially, to have some states saying it's okay to smoke pot and other states still willing to throw the book at you for lighting up? Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. Our email address, update@kcur.org, or you can tweet us @kcuruptodate. Wayne, just this is like the Wayne's World show here. We have two Waynes in the studio, got to keep everybody straight. Wayne Vaught, this notion that I just asked our listeners to chime in here, you know, again, how confusing is it for young people especially to be looking at two sets of laws when things, you know, at least on for an issue that's so important to so many younger folks?
Right. I think it's going to be a point in which parents have to get involved, especially now that you bring up the issue of kids and certainly the anti-drug emphasis that has been in place for a long time. I mean, even my own daughter, now 14, I'm trying to – how are we going to deal with this issue of, well, okay, pot, which has been in this category, now this is not, and we don't want you using this, but we don't want you using other drugs, alcohol as well.
I'm in the same boat, Wayne, at my house.
It, yeah, it really is going to force this conversation to come to the fore. And to think about how do you differentiate between, you know, this Reagan era just say no sort of category versus now, okay, well, let's think about how this really fits in. And it does require a much more elaborate and much more detailed, intelligent conversations than a lot of people are perhaps right now prepared to do. And I think schools are going to have a very difficult time sort of thinking about, well, how does this sort of fit into our overall policies and plans? But, you know, it isn't that unusual. I was just, you know, in a high school doing a basketball game last week, and the issue of drinking is something that was on the wall. And so, you know, talking about kids about not drinking. And
well,
so
when
this
you write your script for how to handle your own daughter, let me borrow it.
I will absolutely let you know because I'm
looking
kind
for
of,
guidance here myself, and I mean that seriously. It's tough now,
right? Because I think it there is a sense in which, well, this sends a sort of a message. Well, maybe this is a legitimate thing to do, especially if you're in a state where it has now been legalized. Though it's going to be within the same genre of how we have treated alcohol. I think certainly when it comes to the issue of kids. But when it gets into the more – when we're talking specifically about adults and about the legislation about it, there are conflicting laws from state to state, but that's not unusual. I mean, cell phone use. I mean, there are a lot of things where you can get into in one state this is legal or hasn't been outlawed. In this state, you text over here and it's illegal. I mean, we have – that's not an unusual situation or something specific.
But this
marijuana
is something a little different because it's so central, at least, you know, for young people. This is a big issue for a lot of
right.
those kids.
And
not
it,
everybody, but a lot of them.
Right. You know? And it has for years been – marijuana has been a – seen or advertised as the, you know, the gateway drug or some other type of genre around that. So it's really going to require us to reframe that conversation to think about, well, what does it mean that mom and dad are, you know, smoking marijuana and having a bourbon or whatever at night, and what does that mean for the house and for society? It's a conversation we're going to have. But that being said, I don't think that there is very strong evidence, any evidence really, to support that the government has a right to come in and restrict this behavior any more than it would, as you know, with a law enforcement against a prohibition to do that against alcohol. Now, what we can do and should do are punish individuals who engage in irresponsible behaviors around anything, whether it's the irresponsible use of alcohol, irresponsible use of recreational drugs.
Yeah.
You punish the behaviors that are inappropriate. And one of the challenges that I think that we have, especially around the use of marijuana, is that there are a lot of harms to people, but I think most of the harms associated with marijuana specifically are due to the laws outlawing marijuana, because it requires this underground access to the drug, and you have crime associated with this black market access to the drug. And so probably a lot of the social harms actually have more to do with the laws against marijuana than legalizing marijuana. Mm. Well, I don't know if Wayne agrees with that or not.
Yeah, there's a couple of things here. When you take a look at the use of the law or the use of the government to restrict things, very often some of the writings of John Stuart Mill come in here, wherein he basically said that if you're living in a democracy or you're looking at protection of liberties, he said the issue becomes about what sort of justification or rationalization is there for the government to restrict your freedoms. And the response that he gave, basically, he says, if we're looking at self-protection, in other words, protecting ourselves from harm, and he distinctly indicated, he says that merely trying to protect someone from their own particular vices or their own harms is not sufficient to justify the government stopping it.
That's interesting.
And so that gets us to start thinking about this notion about harms. You know, what kind of harms are we protecting ourselves from? Now, of course, there's physical, psychological kinds of harms that could happen, but it gets a little broader, of course. If someone is driving under the influence now and potentially, is going to harm you in that manner, can we protect ourselves there?
Because there you're harming others as opposed to yourself.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If drug use, particularly with marijuana or other drugs, starts to become issues in neighborhoods, essentially now, and you're looking at deterioration of families, of communities, and so on, then can we protect ourselves in that respect?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we need to start thinking about, you know, what kind of harms are we trying to protect ourselves from, and what is the purpose of the law?
And when you look at it that way, then, Wayne Lucas, you come down where on this question of making marijuana legal or illegal?
I think that it needs to be decriminalized, at least, and if in fact perhaps even legal. Basically what happens, I think, is that over time the laws change with regards to perspectives and attitudes of people.
Mm-hmm.
And as attitudes and things have changed towards marijuana consumption, then, of course, we find that things are freeing up with respect to applications of the law there. But that doesn't mean that there isn't, you know, some protections that we have to be considering here. And again, the laws reflect that. You know, we talk about youth, for example. Well, none of the states basically legalize this for youth.
Right.
You have to be an adult of age 21, particularly older, to use it.
Is that what it is in Colorado? I wrote it down somewhere. It's got to be 21.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to be 21 to use it. There's usually some restriction in terms of supply, about how that supply is provided and how it's distributed. So we're not looking necessarily at free distribution about this.
Yeah.
that you have to make provisions. Now, there are definitely, while marijuana typically isn't harmful for most people that use it, there are people that do have problems with it.
Yeah.
So you're going to have to make some provisions, essentially, now to be able to respond to those that are having problems with it, whether it be in a mainly from a public health kind of perspective.
Yeah. The ethics of legalizing marijuana, that's our topic for this segment of this edition of The Ethics Professors. Did Colorado and Washington make the right calls here or not to legalize it? How confusing is it maybe in your own household if you have young kids in the house, teenagers perhaps, to make it legal in some states to smoke a pot and illegal in others? And my neighbors tell me the correct usage here is weed. The kids don't call it pot anymore. They call it weed. So there we go. And joining us now from Osceola, Iowa, is the infamous ethics professor himself, Clancy Martin, whose car broke down there and he's been stranded, but he's joining us on the phone. And Clancy, how are you? Thanks for joining us.
I'm doing pretty well. Thanks, Steve.
How's the car?
Hello to both Waynes. It's up on the rack right now waiting for a new timing belt.
So yeah. Oh, man. That'll cost you a few bucks, buddy.
It is. It's 10 hours of labor, and it's cold up here, too, in Iowa.
I bet. Well, give us your take here, Clancy, on this notion. We're talking about the double standards that have been set up and how parents are going to be dealing with this at home with their own kids. What guidelines are you thinking about as you kick this around in your own mind, this new issue that so many parents now have to face?
Sure. I had to deal with this recently with my own 19-year-old daughter who, yes, every time I say the word pot, she corrects me and says, Dad, it's weed.
It's weed.
Pot. She says that that referring to it as pot is somehow pejorative, that's a derogatory word for weed. But anyway, my 19-year-old is a weed smoker and has been since she was about 16 or so when she came out and told us, okay, I've decided I'm going to smoke weed. And we had, the back and forth and about it and finally sort of realized, as you do with teenagers, that you only have so much control over certain things. I mean, I'm not happy about the fact that she smokes weed. I'm not happy about the fact that she smokes cigarettes. But we have to think about what sort of messages we are sending as a society to kids about what adults do and what adults think are permissible. And now three of the things that we think are permissible to adults, and so, kind of by implication, teenagers who want to be adults are sort of encouraged to do are drink alcohol, smoke cigarettes, and now increasingly smoke weed. I mean, I'm with Wayne in that I think that so-called victimless crimes should not be burden our court system, should not create huge social costs, and I'm with the other Wayne in thinking that probably the best way to handle this is through education, through families, through parents, and I think that probably weed in many ways is a less dangerous substance than alcohol, and certainly in terms of its health impacts, as far as we know, is probably a less dangerous substance than cigarettes, But I also think that it's important for us to have a kind of maybe a more open conversation than we have been having about what signals we are sending to our kids about what counts as sort of pleasure and the good life and the sorts of things that adults do consider to be valuable.
And that's not an easy conversation to have, is it, Clancy?
No, I mean, well, we had a terrible time with it. I don't smoke marijuana, but I did when I was my daughter's age. And so I said to her, honey, listen, I can't, without being a hypocrite, tell you that this is something you ought not do because I didn't do it when I was your age. But on the other hand, I have a strong feeling that alcohol, cigarettes, and weed, all three of them, really aren't good for you, and in the long run, probably are going to lead to to disastrous harms, but probably are going to lead at least to modest harms.
Yeah.
And so we talked about that, and she knows what my feelings are about all three of those substances. And they're tough conversations to have, but we also, I think, need to be sort of having them at the national level as well as, you know, among families. One thing that I'm going to be interested to see how it pans out is how police officers are going to deal with this when it comes to the question of testing for inebriation on the road. You know, it's not a good thing to smoke marijuana and drive. But the current breathalyzers, they check for alcohol, but they don't check to see whether or not you've got marijuana in your system.
That's such a great question, Clint. Let's go to Wayne Lucas about that. How is that going to be handled?
I don't know. I really haven't seen that.
Yeah.
Typically, what they would do would most of it's done through urinalysis, though, and so. But that takes a lab. There are some on the spot sort of things you could do, but you know, the collection essentially now becomes an issue. They're not going to stop and try to do a urine collection on the side of the road. It's not reasonable to do that. You're going to have to take persons to a facility, a little more privacy and things such as that.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, I think somebody is going to make some money coming up with a breathalyzer that works for marijuana.
Well, there you go. Legalizing marijuana, the two standards we've now set up in this country, that's our topic today, the ethics of all that. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Let's go to Carly from Lawrence. Carly, you're on Up to Date with the ethics professors. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks, Carly.
Awesome. Well, I've been enjoying listening to you guys. I hail from Lawrence, which is the only municipality in Kansas, I believe, that actually has marijuana decriminalized.
Hmm.
It being the border state to Colorado, we've definitely heard a lot more about marijuana usage in the last couple weeks, in the last months.
Right.
You guys have talked about a lot since I actually called, so I'll just kind of stick to the question that I was responding to, which is that you asked whether or not young people see it as confusing.
Yes.
To have, like, you know, a state that has it legalized for recreational next to a state that actually has some of the most stringent policies. And I think that it really calls into a lot of questions about the efficacy of, like, morality policy and prohibition and whether or not that really does anything and affects people. Because if you look at, you know, alcohol consumption versus marijuana consumption in young people, it's really not that much different anymore. And one's still legal and one's not. And so, it's just kind of calls into the question, you know, the role of morality policy and how it actually shapes how people act.
Do you think it is confusing for young people to see these two standards out there?
I really don't. I don't at all. I'm 22. I have cousins, friends, people that I know that are younger that have talked about this, and I've been talking about these kinds of policies since high school because I did policy debate. But I think there's some really interesting other things going on in society that you have to look at when you think it whether or not it's confusing towards young people. And a big thing is the rise of social media and internet usage, which doesn't seem like a big deal, but when you have, you know, DARE programs in fifth and sixth grade counteracted by social media, by, you know, middle school, and there's things that you can share that talk about, you know, how harmful marijuana actually is, and kids have access to more information than just what they're provided through police officers in school, I think that actually induces a lot of cynicism and broadens kind of their perspectives on things more than just whether or not it's right or wrong. But basically,
sure, if they feel like they're being misled by authorities, right?
Yeah, yeah, Clancy. Carly, I'm sure glad you called. Thanks for making the effort. Appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay.
Have a good one.
Yeah, bye-bye. Let's go to Bob from Fairway. Bob, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead, Bob.
What I was going to say was a comment about how a parent might help their student as they're going away. I know the UC were talking about that, and apparently that's another issue with other parents. My experience is that it's very similar to alcohol. And that if you think whatever the number is of kids on campus using pot, whatever that estimate is, it's probably far too low. I think it's a whole lot more common than we could ever imagine. And I wanted to relate to you a story about, I have property up there that I rent to students. And it was a couple years ago, I had just heard the university president on KCUR. He was the president of the University Presidents Association.
Mm-hmm.
And he was lobbying for the lowering of the age of alcohol on campus. And he was on KCUR, and he was trying to explain why that was a good idea. That same day, I was up in Lawrence. It was just after a new group of students had moved into the house. It was in August. They were coming back to school. And the night before they had been drinking, there were undrunk bottles of beer laying around, more than two. And what that means is that the kids had been drinking so much they forgot where they put their beer, and they just went and got another one. They were, in other words, they were out of control.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to one of the boys, these were a group of boys, I said to one of the boys who was around, I said, hey, you know, I just heard this show about the university president. I said, what would your parents think about you drinking? And the boy said, oh, gosh, my dad would kill me. And, you know, I realized this in a nutshell is the problem. If you don't accept your child and what they do and who they are, it makes it a problem when they get away on their own. They think they almost go overboard.
Yeah.
In what they want to do. And although I think, like what Clancy was saying, it's good to realize that your child needs to maintain control, you need as a parent to explain to them that that's the kind of world that we live in, and they make their own choices, and it's just a choice.
Yeah. Bob, I'm glad you called. Thanks for the good phone call. Appreciate it.
Okay, sure.
You
sure.
Bet. Let me grab one more call before a break here. Let's go to Michael from Kansas City, Missouri. Michael, you're on Up to Date. Good morning. Go ahead, Michael.
I was listening, and you were talking about the laws and how far do we go to protect ourselves. You know, laws to protect ourselves from self-harm.
Right.
And I was wondering, how do you think, or what do you think makes the difference between what you're saying with marijuana being a victimless crime and seatbelts or helmet laws? How do we make the distinction between protecting ourselves from one thing or another?
Wayne Vaught?
Well, it's raising one, on the one hand, the issue of paternalism, forcing people to do things that you think are in their best interest. Now, actually, seatbelt laws, helmet laws have typically been largely promoted by insurance companies because the fear of liabilities from individuals who are not properly restrained in a car and there's an accident and you're injured. The severity of that injury, the likely outpouring of insurance funds to cover the injuries if you're not restrained is going to be greater if you're not in your seatbelt than if you are. So there is one on the other hand. On the one hand, it's a paternalistic, or seems to come across as a paternalistic intervention, that we're passing the law because it's in your best interest to wear the seatbelt, when in reality most of the push for that has been because of the harms. And you could argue that this is now a social harm. If I don't wear my seatbelt and I'm hurt, that is going to cause the insurance companies to have to pay more money, which means the insurance pool is going to raise, which collectively insurance
yeah.
rates will go up. And you can argue that similarly with the healthcare laws that have now been passed and a variety of things that we do that really kind of are for that person's best interest, but it's for their best interest because not doing it has a potential real significant negative social impact
mm-hmm.
that they're actually trying to avoid. So,
you know, Wayne Luke, is this notion, you know, going back to the enforcement idea that, you know, apparently the Colorado residents and visitors are allowed to possess up to an ounce of pot, though non-residents can only buy a quarter ounce at a time, according to the new law, and no one is permitted to take it out of state. I'm guessing that enforcement of a set of laws like that is not going to be very easy to do.
You're right. You're right.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be very difficult. It takes, of course, a commitment of personnel and resources, essentially, to literally watch that,
mm-hmm.
to monitor, essentially, the sales and the customers, characteristics of customers and so on at the at the marijuana distribution points. And, you know, frankly, that's it's a lot of money and a lot of resources that, you know, might be demanded in other areas.
Yeah. We received this email. Clancy Martin, I'll come to you with this. What about the dichotomy of liberalization of marijuana use while continuing the crackdown on tobacco? After making great strides in public health by educating Americans on the dangers of tobacco use, now we have more and more states legalizing the use of marijuana. What about that?
Right. Well, I mean, it's certainly the case that every time we legalize a drug that has any sort of negative health risks, there's going to be social costs involved. I mean, we're all going to, at the end of the day, wind up paying for it in our insurance. And there's a good legitimate question. I mean, and to be fair, it's not simply restricted to alcohol, tobacco, and marijuana. The same question applies when it comes to a whole host of pharmaceutical drugs, which are also legal and abused and very often have negative health impacts. So it's a gigantic question. But one of the debates that we probably are not having enough when it comes to the marijuana debate is what sort of the larger direction that we think we're headed to when it comes to our tendency towards increased tolerance of a variety of different pleasure creating substances in the country. I mean, I don't think that we do well to put people who are smoking weed in prison. But I do think we need to recognize that there are far-reaching, as this email indicates, there are far-reaching implications for any time we collectively make the decision to make a thing that we know to be harmful legal.
We're talking about the legalization of marijuana and the ethics behind that. Interesting email here from Jerry, who writes, May I offer my own perspective as a retired firefighter. During my 25 years responding to medical calls and emergencies of all types, I can't recall one case where someone under the influence of marijuana acted in a violent way toward their spouse, girlfriend, or children. But my memory is swamped by violent incidents caused by the influence of alcohol. I do not use drugs myself, and my consumption of alcohol is almost nil. I have no dog in this fight. Perhaps other emergency responders might have a different perspective. Interesting, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely right.
Yeah. We go to Turner here from Overland Park. Turner, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Hi. How are you?
Well, thanks. Go ahead.
Yes, I'd just like to talk about the gateway theory. A lot of people say marijuana is a gateway drug to harder drugs, but actually most children or young people who experiment start with tobacco or alcohol before they even try marijuana. And while most marijuana users do not actually go on to use harder drugs, it is true that most hard drug users have used marijuana at some time, but they don't continue to use marijuana because it doesn't give them the desired effect. But they do have, you know, ongoing problems with alcohol or whatever drug they are abusing. And I think you'll find most addicts are tobacco users. You know, that's one of the only things that you're allowed to have in rehab centers is tobacco. And it is not healthier than marijuana, and neither is alcohol. Those are both way more dangerous than marijuana. They don't have medical value.
Yeah. Clancy Martin, weigh in on that, would you please?
Yeah, I would like to, because I think that the caller's making a really interesting point. I mean, my own experience, I've had quite a lot of experience when it comes to addiction and addicts, and I would, in large, agree with what the caller has said. That is, alcohol and other drugs to which people are commonly addicted, whether it's pharmaceuticals or, you know, the kinds of really scary ones we think of, like a methamphetamine, et cetera.
Yeah.
They all tend to go together in a cluster. And when you talk to people in rehab, you don't really find them pining away for their pot. It just doesn't happen, you know. You hear them pining away for alcohol, for, you know, whiskey. You hear them pining away for their whatever kind of diazepam or whatever kind of the word is slipping my mind at the moment. In any event, some kind of Valium-related drug,
right.
OxyContin, whatever it is, you don't find them pining away for marijuana. And I do think that when it comes to the question of the most socially harmful drugs, marijuana is going to be very low on the list. And in that sense, it's probably the case if we were going to really thoughtfully look at what drugs should be legal and what should be illegal, much better to decriminalize marijuana and criminalize alcohol than the other way around.
Right. Okay. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll change topics here with our ethics professors. We'll move to the case of 33-year-old Marlise Munoz down in Fort Worth, brain dead, collapsed on the kitchen floor with what appeared to be a blood clot in her lungs. Her family wanted to honor her wish not to be left on life support, but the state of Texas is saying, that's because she's pregnant. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our conversation yesterday with author Joyce Maynard or our discussion about the Kansas Board of Regents' new social media policy, just go to our website at kcur.org to hear those conversations. I'm glad the state of Missouri isn't wrestling with that social media policy now,
right.
Dean Vaught.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tomorrow on the show, tune in for an encore broadcast of our interview with author Michael Chabon. We'll also have a new 90-mile view and our local listen. We're talking, at least we were talking in our first half, about the legalization of marijuana. And Wayne Lucas, you want to talk a little bit about this notion of the gateway drug aspect and what the research shows on that point.
Yeah, the research does not really show any evidence of sort of a gateway drug phenomena. It is true that most people have used heroin, cocaine, and so on, have experience with other drugs as they were before they got to that particular point. But the converse isn't true. It doesn't mean just because you smoke cigarettes, because you use alcohol, because you use marijuana, that you're going to graduate or go on to anything else.
And how is it all this skewed by age?
You find particularly with marijuana and with other drugs as well that about from 16 up to about their mid-20s is the time that most people become involved with these drugs. And it's kind of a curve. It goes up till about 20, 21, and then it starts to come down. And the explanation for it very often is that individuals get into their mid-20s, they're starting to establish themselves in adult careers. And drinking and drugging competes with success in those kinds of elements. You can't be a good parent. You can't be successful in your job. You can't be good community leader or whatever then if you're drinking and drugging.
Well, maybe just the idea if you're drinking and drugging, maybe you can't do well in college. Maybe that idea needs to get out there someday.
Absolutely. You know? Right. Well,
how's that for a concept? Yeah.
Right. Okay. You could do better on your exams.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's move on here to the case of 33-year-old Marlise Munoz, who was brain dead in Fort Worth after collapsing on her kitchen floor from what appeared to be a blood clot in her lungs. This was back in November. But as her parents and her husband prepared to say their final goodbyes in the ICU to honor her wish not to be left on life support, they were stunned when a doctor told them the hospital was not going to comply with their instructions. Mrs. Munoz was 14 weeks pregnant, and Texas is one of more than two dozen states that prohibit, with varying degrees of strictness, medical officials from cutting off life support to a pregnant patient. Clancy Martin, whose interest should win out here, the families or the states?
Yeah, this is a very tough one. It's, you know, it's a really complex one because it gets into our these deep questions that we need to talk about the relationship between privacy and when someone becomes a person, whether or not a fetus is a person, does that person, if the fetus is a person, then that person has rights, and those rights ought to be protected by the state. I mean, that's why we have a state, is to protect our rights. And, you know, of course,
does the fetus have rights, Clancy? Explain that to me.
Well, it's different people go different ways, as you know. If we think that a fetus is a person, if we think that a fetus in one way or another qualifies in the same way that the rest of us human beings tromping around America do, it's for personhood, then that fetus gets the same rights that all the rest of us do and needs to be protected by the state, just like all the rest of us are, including, most importantly, protecting our lives. Other people think that no, until the Supreme Court presently thinks that until the fetus is viable, it's not entitled to those rights, and that's what Roe versus Wade is all about. However, there are also an awful lot of people in the country, as you know, and this is what the whole debate about abortion focuses on, that a fetus, it could count as a person as early as conception, or as early as it is implanted in the uterine wall. And we talk about all the different stages at which maybe this being that is growing and living inside the womb is at least becoming increasingly person-like. So, yeah. It's just a very, very tough question. My own intuitions tend to go with what the court decided in Roe versus Wade, which is once the fetus can maintain its own life independent of the mother, then it ought to qualify for the same rights as the rest of us do.
And at this point, at 14 weeks pregnant, the fetus could not do that, could not survive on its own.
That's right. And mm-hmm. that's one of the reasons people fuss about the viability criterion. Viability is what we call this criterion, because it is changing as technology advances. The viability gets earlier and earlier on in the pregnancy, and we don't like something as important as life and death to be settled necessarily at the moral level by yeah. advances in technology. And Wayne Vaught is an expert on this question. He knows more about it than probably anybody else in the state of Missouri or Kansas.
Well, with that kind of introduction, how can you blow this one, Wayne? Where do ethnicists tend to come down on this question of what traditionally carries more weight? I mean, the wishes of the individual, the wishes of the state.
I think this will come back, this will be a nice opportunity for me to challenge Clancy's position. At least I don't think this is an issue of the viability. I don't think it really is his issue to know a fetus at all, and that really can cloud the water. Ethicists typically have, for the past 30 years in biomedical ethics, focused on the right of the individual, the autonomy of a person to have bodily integrity and make decisions for him or herself. What we're finding with laws like this that basically dismiss the expressed written wishes of an individual to have their body treated the way they want to have it, even if there is a viable fetus, and let's make it viable. Let's say it isn't 22, 24-week pregnancy, and the woman says, no, I don't want to be kept alive in that situation. Basically, we have this double standard. We were talking about this issue with marijuana before. If my good friend Wayne Lucas were to collapse right here in the floor and he needs a couple pint of my blood to do it, I could say no, and nobody could force me mm-hmm. to give up a fairly innocuous thing, to give blood to save his life. There's no legal requirement for me to do it. I wouldn't be obliged to do it. I couldn't be prosecuted if I didn't do it. It would just, some people would say, well, that's immoral. You should have done something to help your good friend. It's like, well, I don't like needles. I don't want to do it. Here we have a situation where a pregnant woman has, let's say it's a real live human being, says, look, I don't want my body to be used this way to keep another human being alive. But we're saying now you're a pregnant woman. You don't have the same rights as a non-pregnant person has. And what we have is a double standard that diminishes the right of a pregnant woman to decide what's going to happen to her body in a way that we wouldn't compel any other human being to have some obligation to another live human being to save their life. Now, we could argue that she has an ethical obligation to do it, But from a legal perspective and what the courts are doing, I think, is we're creating this two-tiered system where pregnant women don't have the same rights as non-pregnant.
Well, that is said very well. We're going to have to leave our conversation right there. I want to thank Wayne Vaught and Clancy Martin and Wayne Lucas, all from UMKC, for coming in and sharing the duties of ethics professors one more time this week. And thank you all so much for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Always good to have you guys.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Thanks, Clancy. You bet.